Hi everyone, my name is Patrick Akil, and for today's episode, I have my friend Lucas Montano over. He's a senior Android developer over at Disney, and we talk about a lot of stuff. How Android development is different from backend development, how his love from content creation originated, and how he finds new ideas, like figuring out how Mr. Beast is going to do his famous tweet giveaways, even though the APIs on Twitter suck. Enjoy! Beyond coding. What do you do at Disney exactly?
I am an Android engineer.
Android?
Yeah.
And I looked up on LinkedIn what you did previously, and it's always been kind of mobile development, no?
Well, my background is from as a backend. Mm. So So I started with VB6.
Yeah.
That was my first programming language, and then PHP, and then Java. Then I bought my first Android phone, like in 2009, 2010, and then I switched to mobile. Yeah.
So back then, everything was app development, no? People were like, this is the next big thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like people wanted to put their websites inside an app, basically. Mm-hmm. In the beginning, it was like that, right? So there was no market in Brazil in 2009. And I was learning how to code in Android, in Java. So there was no one hiring an Android engineer, right?
Yeah.
So I had to create my company, like consultancy, to create apps for other companies. But most of companies and clients, they wanted to put their website inside an app, you know? So in the beginning, it was like that. There was no like app. Let's build the app.
Yeah.
It's like, let's build what we have on the web in an app.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was that the most of the client requests that came to you?
Yeah.
Yeah, right? And why did you stop with your, because you said you built a company around this? I think very early on when apps were kind of prevalent, so you were even, let's say, on top of the game or ahead of the game on that front. Why did you stop when it came to kind of your own company and your own business?
I failed a lot, I think. Yeah. So it was not one company. I think I started like three companies and all of them failed.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this first one, we didn't succeed to get more good clients, because that's a thing, right? You need to get good clients. So yeah, we got, I think, shitty clients in the beginning. So it was very hard to make plans or to hire more people. So we grew like to five to six engineers working with me and my partner.
Mm.
And but then things got like one client didn't pay, you know? So you have a cash flow problem. You need to go back to the market, start working again.
Yeah.
So that's what happened.
That's rough.
Yeah. So in 2000, I think we founded the company in 2011. And then 2013, I think, I had to go back to the market,
Was that the period from 2011 to 2013? Did you start multiple companies in that period?
Multiple apps, but below this umbrella company,
And then you continued with app development from that point on? You didn't go back to backend?
No.
Why didn't you go back to backend? Like, because I feel like app development was very much booming in exactly that period, right? It was like, this is the future. Basically, everything was going to mobile. And I feel like nowadays, if I'm in public transport, everyone is on their mobile phone. So it's still very prevalent. Yet backend engineering and like the web never went away. I feel like they're kind of, either combining or it gets easier to go hand in hand in that way.
Yeah. I don't know why I didn't go back, but I like the experience. I like the feeling of having created an app and then you see someone using in their phone, you know? It's just like, maybe I like the front end side, the client implementation.
Yeah,
the impact, I can see that. That they can do it. But on my personal projects, like for the YouTube channel, for instance, when I'm starting a project, a lot of times I go back end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because are you mainly using Kotlin nowadays, or are you still doing Java?
I do Kotlin now.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah. As an Android engineer, I do Kotlin.
Yeah. And does that, I mean, can you do Kotlin for iOS as well nowadays?
Yeah, you can. Mm. You have Kotlin multi-platform, KMP.
Yeah.
Yeah. They renamed, I think it was KMM, but now it's KMP.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
I've heard of KMM. I didn't know about the name change. But do you do, you're still focused on Android, right?
Yeah.
Do you think platforms are moving to a point where everyone's just going to use whatever language, whether that's React Native or Kotlin in that way, and then develop for both iOS and Android?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think as long as we have Apple being Apple, we are going to always have like two native platforms, you know, Android using Kotlin, iOS using Swift.
Yeah.
Because Apple is like a closed system. So yeah, they push back a lot of things. Now in Europe, not that much, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, until now, every browser in the app browser in iOS was the same, behind the scenes was Safari.
Yeah.
So if you download Chrome or Firefox on your iOS, it is basically WebKit from Apple, right?
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
So the engine is the same as Safari.
Okay.
So that's why, like, if you do web progress, like, you can have that, you cannot have all the features that you would get in Android, for instance.
Okay.
Yeah. But now in Europe, they need to comply some rules, right?
They can't do that anymore?
Now like Google will be able to fully implement Chrome.
Ah, okay.
iOS. Yeah, so this is changing.
I never knew about that, actually. I shouldn't say never. Like, I've dabbled a bit with mobile development, a bit from the React Native side, and I built kind of the back end, let's say, for a later project, which was an IoT project where we had a lot of data, and then we fed it to a React Native app in that way. So I did stuff with notifications, and I was really happy to see that people already thought of, okay, how do I send a push notification to someone and it pops up and stuff like that. But what would you say is like a big difference when it comes to mobile development and, for example, traditional web development or backend development in that way?
Oh, I think the biggest difference is that when you release something, it is released, right? Like, it is there in the user's cell phone.
Yeah.
And you don't have any guarantee that the user will upgrade or it will update your app, you know? So if you ship a bug, you need to think like, okay, how can I fix this?
Yeah.
Because the user might not want to update the app,
right?
So it can still be in a version like 10 versions ago. So from the beginning, when you are creating an app, you need to think like, okay, how can we enforce the user to update?
Mm.
So your app need to have some kind of local logic to do that.
Yeah.
You need to also have, of course, like versions on your APIs and config files, you know, so you can enable or disable features on the fly in case the user are using a feature that you don't want no longer to support or something like that. Yeah.
Do you do those? So those are dynamic configs then? You don't ship them with the app code?
You ship the configs with the app code, yeah.
Okay.
You can do, like, you can push code with React Native, for instance.
Yeah.
On Native, we used to, Native, I mean, like, Kotlin, Java for Android, we used to, we ship the app with config, like, if and else in the code.
Yeah.
So it will enable and disable based on this config. Yeah.
Yeah, makes sense.
We call feature flag or...
Yeah. I thought those would be kind of dynamic, because otherwise you have the same challenge, right? If someone, let's say, if you enable a feature due to a feature flag, someone would still need to update if it's shipped with the bundle, or wouldn't they?
What do you mean?
So let's say I have a new version,
okay,
and in that version my feature is disabled.
Okay.
I thought if you have a dynamic config, you can just toggle, let's say, the feature on, and people don't have to update there.
Yeah, that's what happens.
Ah, okay, in that way. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So you can do like even, you can roll out the feature gradually.
Yeah.
Like for 1% of the users, 5%, 10%.
Mm.
Yeah, you can do experiments. Yeah.
That's nice. Do you do a lot of experiments on the app side?
Yeah.
Because I have experience when it comes to like A-B testing on the web. Is that easy to do on mobile as well?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So both rollouts as well as A-B testing is all in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And do you use, does Disney, I don't know how much you can talk about Disney specifically, but do they use that a lot?
I think I cannot talk that much, but they do. Because you do that a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. And a lot of like, I like that a lot of decision making nowadays used to be, okay, market-driven design, we try and make a lot of assumptions and we test those with the users and then we do features. Mm-hmm. And now you have this trend of, okay, we do all of that, sometimes a little bit more, sometimes a little bit less. And then we actually see with A/B testing and experiments what actually hits. Because I feel like, especially with mobile and also on web, the more features you build, first of all, your code base gets very complex. And second of all, your velocity goes down because of that complexity. And if the features don't get used, they're just there. Yeah. And they might be either in the way, especially from a code perspective, but from a user perspective as well. So it would be best if we remove them. But I feel like sometimes, especially from the development side, we're just adding stuff.
Yeah.
Adding and adding and adding until we say, okay, it's too slow or it's rubbish or code is outdated and we do it again.
Yeah.
That's like the cycle.
It's crazy. Sometimes like I feel like we are always creating new frameworks, new libraries to use to be faster and deliver more features.
Yeah.
And then you want to buy a flight ticket and the app keeps like restarting your whole search. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like you go to the flow to buy a flight ticket and then something fails and then you need to restart everything again.
Yeah,
like
all
it's
of
the
it.
Most basic feature on app, buy a ticket.
Yeah.
So I feel like I don't know. I have the feeling that the websites or apps, they are not getting faster, you know?
Yeah. I don't know if that's due to more features or do they need to, let me take a step back. Sometimes on web, and I don't know how this is on the app side, but if we, for example, select a database or if we select certain solutions, people like to compare speed, right?
Yeah.
Because better is faster or faster is better when it comes to kind of user experience and maybe even conversion. But at some point I'm like, okay, how much faster do we actually need it to be? Because when I'm talking about a web page, I've built a web shop and that was like statically rendered, a lot of it, very minimal JavaScript. And that was like super fast. And I don't think we could get it faster, but I didn't know if that was going to make a big difference. Is that for the app side? Does speed really matter in that way as well? Like even those tiny, tiny differences?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I think that's the one of the most interesting thing about working with apps, mobile apps.
Yeah.
It's because you have millions of different devices and you need to support all of them.
Yeah.
Like a big company as Disney, we need to support all kinds of TVs, TV box, Android, or Fire Stick from Amazon. So a lot of different partners.
Mm. You
know? So it's not about always like your app need to be fast, but your app need to run in certain devices that have low memory, you know? So you need to care more about resource.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How much of a hassle is that when it comes to actually developing?
Yeah, you need to, the first thing, like if you want to become like a senior mobile engineer, you need to be good at profiling the app.
Okay.
You know, app inspection and just like figure it out why your app's consuming that much memory or in which thread it is running.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which scheduler and so on.
I didn't know about that actually. That is, it makes sense when you lay it out like that. Like there's just, I mean, hardware has improved, but people still have old hardware, especially when it comes to TVs. TVs nowadays are cheap.
Yeah.
But people don't buy cheap TVs if they already have a TV, especially if they bought it for a hefty price, let's say years ago. And then you have older hardware that runs on that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Would you say like great mobile engineers also like think about low level stuff like that?
Yeah.
They have to, no?
I think so. Yeah. So it doesn't matter if you code in React Native, Flutter, or Kotlin or Swift.
Yeah.
Like you need to care about the resource that the app is consuming, you know?
Yeah. And I'm thinking about, let's say I come from operations and in that way, we usually, when there was new software, I had to test it. And back then I was working in retail. So I actually had a physical test set up when it comes to like registers and stuff like that, which I would patch the software on. And then I would see if I could scan everything. And that would be like a more manual test. When it comes to mobile, and especially when you talk about the suite and the range of, let's say, TVs, Android phones, different versions, and what you need to support, how do you test all of that when it comes to actually putting stuff to production?
Yeah. So it's very hard to get all the device. Right?
Yeah.
So if you are like a freelancer, you won't have all the device.
No.
If you work at Disney will have a lot of device for you to test. But nowadays, you can use also a device in the cloud. Mm. So there are companies that provide that. You can run your tests in all kinds of device in the cloud. So
that's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes sense that they would kind of solve that solution in that way.
Yeah. Even Google, like in the Play Store, like they have with Firebase, you can also run tests in the cloud and you can see, yeah.
Very nice.
And you can do like rollout in small percentage, like roll out your app to 1% of the user base and check the logs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And do like a bubble rollout in that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes sense. I do like the trend that, I mean, I don't know how it is on Android because I have an iPhone. That my iPhone basically updates either stuff on the background or really says, okay, now you have to update. So then from a software side, we still built in the same check that you said when it comes to, okay, at some point we need to force people to update. So it's in the software as well.
Yeah.
But at least from the App Store side, automatic updates just roll out most of the time. Is that on Android as well?
Yeah, you can do that.
Yeah, it's good,
well.
Right? Yeah, that makes it, from a developer standpoint, I think that's a really nice app.
Yeah. Yeah. But there is a funny thing, like that I am an iOS user as well. Mm. But I'm an Android engineer for more than a decade now, but I use an iOS as well.
Yeah. Why is that? You don't want that?
I don't know. But I have it tattooed in my arm as well.
Really?
Yeah, just like a funny joke. It's the first Apple computer running an Android side of it.
That's funny, man. Yeah. That's cool. I was wondering, because you laid out kind of this step in entrepreneurship that you made when it comes to kind of creating your own company. I'm sure you made a lot of apps and you do a lot of like hobby projects as well. Mm-hmm. But are you still thinking about starting your own company down the line and doing that again? Or what are you thinking when it comes to entrepreneurship?
Well, I think content is the new app, right? So in 2010, I launched my first app. Like it was called Finanças Pessoais. It's basically like a personal finance management app.
Yeah.
And the app went great. Like, so because back then people, they wanted to download apps, you know? So like in 2 years, the app reached 1 million downloads and
wow.
I was able to, you know, to get some revenue from it and have like, different source of revenue. That's my first like rule in life. Like you need to have more than one source of revenue. And I always did that in side project, doing side projects like apps. But nowadays, like people don't download app that much. Like if you are having dinner with a friend, you are not gonna say like, "Hey man, look this new app I download." No one do that anymore.
Not anymore. It used to be like that.
It used to be like that. Now people say like, "Wow, look this new, look how funny is this 10-second video that I have on Instagram, you know."
Yeah.
Or this new AI stuff.
Mm.
So yeah, that's the new app.
Yeah.
AI and content.
Yeah. And I know you're playing around with that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think now my side projects are around content and I'm playing with AI, but not that much.
Not that much? Not yet?
Not yet. I want to see what happens. Like when OpenAI, they now have GPTs, right? So they create like the GPTs store. You can explore new GPTs. So I launched like 2 GPTs just to see what happens. But no, people are not downloading that much or not. They are not using that much.
Yeah. It's not like the early days of the App Store.
No.
Yeah.
It is not.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. I like how you put it because I did used to. Like, especially I was younger as a teenager, I used to download apps, mainly games, but also to see like, okay, what is out there? Nowadays, no, I don't download stuff anymore.
No.
Somehow, sometimes there's one app that all of a sudden all my friends then use. Then I'm like, how did this slip in? Like one is, for example, it came from the UK, it's Splitwise, where we went as a group on a vacation and then people just pay, you put it in the app and then at the end it breaks down the split. But I don't know how that got established, let's say. It's really hard, I feel like, as an app nowadays to get that popularity in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard to get traffic to the app. It's not that much organic anymore. Like, as a YouTuber, I can launch an app and then I can maybe try to drive audience to download the app. But if you don't have an audience, then it's very hard to launch an app and get like a million downloads just because people like and are sharing with their friends. It's very hard to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that you said that it does go hand in hand with the content side of things.
Yeah.
I do see a lot of, let's say, content creators start creating and expanding their revenue stream, but also just their platform and their influence in that way. Because if you have a community that's built around the content that you create, and you create more content in a different way, like videos is not just a silver bullet. For example, I know a person I had on the podcast, he's creating like this learning platform where it's similar to LeetCode, but more for data science. And he's really working hard on that platform. And because he has an audience, he thinks this might be a great fit for them to keep learning next to kind of the video content that he creates. Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool.
So similarly, an app could work in that way as well. But nowadays, yeah, I've always thought it would be a cool idea to create apps or maybe even like plugins. Browser plugins are kind of in the same avenue, I feel like. I read these stories on Twitter where people say I make so much money with browser plugins and apps. And I'm like, is that still a thing? But I'm happy you see it differently as well. That, yeah, it's kind of not the main thing anymore. You have to have stuff around it.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. What type of videos do you like content creation wise creating?
Mostly about stuff that I'm thinking.
Mm.
Yeah. You know, so sometimes I see a tweet and I just like, oh, okay. I think differently or I don't agree with this. And maybe I would mention that to a friend. What I do is like a hit record and I mention to my audience. That's basically it.
Do you have an example of like a thing that you found on Twitter that was like interesting where you wanted to talk about it?
Yeah. Most recently, I saw the Mr. Beast tweet.
Mm.
You know, Mr. Beast, he uploaded his first video, I think, to X.
Yeah.
And it reached like millions of people. Mm-hmm. And then I think it was 1 week ago, he said like, okay, I will share my revenue from this video to 10 people.
So okay.
You can retweet. If you repost my tweet, you are in the game.
Mm.
I will randomly choose 10 of you. And I look at that tweet and I think like, okay, that's good, right? I think I'm going to repost. No, my friends will see that I want money from reposting a tweet, so maybe I will not. But then I started looking like, but this is very interesting. I will repost. Then I saw like, okay, there are like 4 million people that repost this tweet.
Yeah.
And I start to think like, okay, how Mr. Beast will select 10 people from 4 million people. So that hooked me. Like, let's try to figure out how we can technically build a script that will do this, you know. Then I start creating content around that. So I start a project to implement like how we can use a Twitter API to fetch these 4 million retweets.
Yeah.
And then select 10 of them.
Wow.
Yeah. So then, yeah, that was one of the most recently thing that I found on Twitter.
That's a really cool use case.
Yeah, because the Twitter API has a API rate limit.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing is like you have three tiers of API. Like as a developer, you can buy like you can use the API for free, but you don't have access to the retweeted by API, or you can pay $100 monthly.
Okay.
To use this API, but you have an API rate limit of 5 requests per 15 minutes.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
That's never going to work.
No, it will take me 77, almost like 80 days to run the script without considering errors or, you know, internet issues. And then you have the pro tier that you need to pay 5,000 per month to Twitter, to X.
It jumps up like that.
Yeah.
Wow.
To have 75 requests per 15 minutes.
It's not even that much.
No. And that means that if Mr. Beast would pay the maximum tier to do this, it would take him 5 days.
Yeah.
But he promised to select 10 people in 72 hours.
Mm.
So I was like wondering how he's doing it.
Yeah.
Does Elon Musk send
open the gates?
Yeah, open the like database or send a file with everyone? So that was like what got me interested.
Yeah.
To create this content. So I will upload the video, this video next week. So there is also you can do enterprise tier, but you need to fill in a form and you need to be already spending 42,000 monthly with Twitter.
I didn't know the numbers got up that high. Yeah. That is insane. Yeah. Then probably he has something with regards to the enterprise tier.
Maybe, yeah. Or maybe a different way of doing, like maybe he's actually using the search API and choosing based on timestamp. I don't know.
Interesting. I like that your use case. Some of the content creators I see are like, okay, let's use this programming language and then we make a calculator or we make something simple and they all have the same type of projects, like a widget or a smaller app that does something. But you're actually like, man, the inspiration for your solution, when you laid it out like that, I was like, that is very interesting because I have no clue how you would do that. And then you get those, let's say, functional constraints. Your API sucks, basically, or you have to pay thousands and thousands of dollars. How do you do that?
Yeah.
That's fun stuff.
And the trick part is that the API, the pages, they are tokenized.
Mm.
So you cannot like from, okay, if you have 100, because each page, the API will return 100 people, 100 registers per page.
Yeah.
So you could basically have, you know that you have 37,000 pages or 40,000 pages for 4 million retweets. So you could basically randomly choose 10 pages, right? And then you just do 10 fetches and the API, then it's okay. But the pages are tokenized. So you cannot fetch like, give me the second page, give me the page number 30.
Yeah, because you need the next token.
You need the next token. So you need to actually fetch all the pages.
One by one, linearly.
One by one. And you cannot, you cannot do parallel.
No.
No.
No, I was thinking, I like thinking in solutions also. So I was thinking maybe you can do it parallel, but I'm assuming if there's a rate limit, it's based on the key.
Exactly.
And I don't know if you can do multiple keys, but then the page token, that's like, you can't do much then. You have to do it linearly.
Yeah.
Okay. So did you end up solving this or this is like that?
Yeah, I solved it. I solved fetching the 40,000 pages.
Okay.
So the script is still running.
Yeah,
it's running. I need to wait, but 77, almost 80 days. But what I did to just demonstrate to the video, I create a mock server and I set up a proxy using Charles Prox. So basically my script is fetching, is trying to fetch the data from Twit, but my proxy will redirect that to my mock server. And my mock server is generating fake pages.
Mm.
So just to demonstrate if the script is working or not.
Yeah, that makes sense. Otherwise, it's within days, you will either know if it's right or wrong. And then if it's wrong, that investment in days, you're not going to get back. That's funny, man. Do you, like, to come up with ideas like that, it takes a certain way of thinking and to see an opportunity there. I don't think everyone could do that. I wouldn't have thought of that. I didn't see the tweet, but I never wonder like, okay, how can you do this? But you do. Do ideas just pop up like that? Or do you keep a log of ideas that you want to execute on?
Yeah, I keep a log of ideas.
Mm.
But yeah, usually they come like that. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. How big is your log of ideas? Like how many are we talking about that are in there, you'd say?
Well, so I think 1 year ago I switched from talking about a random subject to react to content. Mm. So my main content is like me reacting to an article.
Okay.
All right. So that's the way we can have consistency. So we post videos on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, 3 days a week.
Yeah.
So we have a format. Okay, so I will be reacting to articles 3 days a week.
Yeah.
But sometimes there are like this tweet from Mr. Beast, then okay, this is interesting, let's put it in the pipeline to deliver the content.
Yeah. No, that makes sense.
So I have a roadmap of articles that I want to react. But I have this like small projects that comes. Yeah.
And the when it comes to, let's say, the excitement, I can give you an example of the podcast. This is my favorite part. These are the conversations is what I like. I don't like doing the planning. I don't like doing the finding of people. But I do that because I really enjoy this part. I even like the editing part, but at some point it gets mundane and it's like time heavy. And the release part is like more so the fun part. Then that's when you see it go live, let's say. What about the video content creation part? Do you like the most? Do you actually like the research and reviewing articles? Do you like the shooting with the camera?
I like when I need to develop a project.
Mm.
Yeah. Because also like one of the things that I figured out early in my YouTube channel was that my content need to be, first of all, it needs to entertain.
Mm.
But it needs to be an entertainment that doesn't generate guilty in the audience. You know?
Okay.
It can be that kind of video like that you watch the video, it's very entertaining, but then you're like, oh, why am I watching this?
Yeah.
Just for entertainment.
Like popcorn content.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like the audience needs to, for me, like they need to finish the video with the feeling that they learned something.
Mm.
And I think that when I found something like this Mr. Beast tweet, like this is the best for these two pillars.
Yeah.
You know, because it's entertainment, but you also will learn something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's what you like, finding
exactly
those opportunities.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. That also makes sense with kind of your Android history, let's say, because one of the things you said when it comes to why you like Android development versus backend development is making that difference for the end user in that way.
Yeah.
And it shows in your content then as well.
I think so.
Yeah. I think it's genius because everyone knows Mr. Beast. That example, I love it. I'm going to check out the video because I'm also interested.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you, when it comes to, let's say, the technical side, do you experiment with different languages? Do you like the technical stuff as well? Because it feels like you're very much solution driven. You like solving problems rather than figuring out or playing around with the technical stuff.
Yeah. So I think it has been like 3 months ago, I was like, I need to learn Rust.
Mm.
I think it's quite interesting programming language, you know, because I come from Java. So I hate garbage collector. You know?
Yeah.
But I also did some C++. So I hate malloc and having to, you know, allocate memory myself and thinking
boot
about
all yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Rust is just in the middle.
Mm.
Like, so, okay, I need to learn Rust, but I need a motive to learn Rust. Mm. I don't like to go like, let's go to the Rust documentation and let's do the hello world. Or let's see an article about how to build a calculator. I don't like to learn like that.
Yeah.
I like to learn in a project. So for this Mr. Beast project, I thought, okay, let's learn Rust while I'm doing this. So yeah.
Nice.
That's how I learn new things.
Yeah.
But it's not because of the tech, not because of like Rust itself, but it needs to be combined with a project.
Yeah, you find an opportunity, a problem to solve, and then use it as a learning opportunity as well.
Yeah.
I think I've seen more and more, like even my colleagues do that, like Rafael that's listening, he also does that. Hernani is another colleague, he does that a lot as well, where they, first of all, they find a problem or they want to learn something and they either create content through kind of that learning and they talk about that, or they create videos similar to what you do when it comes to solving a problem like that. And I think that's really smart because you, in parallel, you do a lot of things at the same time. And I think it amplifies your learning journey because you're not, I mean, if you're starting out with Rust, especially Rust has like this huge learning curve, is ridiculous. If you create content on that and someone that has, let's say, a few years of experience sees that, they can also give you feedback. It's like you're not learning by yourself then, because people can help you in that way if you're open to that, because it can also be confronting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you gotten any feedback when it came to your code or the solutions in that way from the audience as well? How interactive is that?
Well, for this challenge, I chose to do live. Mm. So it was like 5 private lives for my members from YouTube membership program. So I did with the audience help me in the chat.
Yeah.
Also using ChatGPT or, you know.
That's nice.
Just like regular, how I... like what I like is like I don't like to resolve the problem before going live.
Okay.
No, when I'm doing live code with my audience, I like to just make mistakes because I want them to see how it is actually to learn a new language, you know. So I just go like open chest, like, okay.
Yeah.
I actually don't know how to do that in Rust.
Yeah.
Let's search together. Then I go to Google because then the audience can learn how to also figure out
how to
solve a problem that you don't know how to solve.
Which is the most important skill.
Exactly. Probably.
Yeah, that's really nice. And it doesn't, you don't get nervous doing that because I can see from my side, if I were to do that, you need to have an ego, which is very low. Let's say you barely have to have, you don't have to have an ego to do that. If your ego is high, you're never going to do that. You're going to be that person that prepares and is like, okay, I know how to do that. And then I'm going to show them how to do that.
Yeah. I think I learned how to solve problems because I start coding with 12.
Mm.
So for me, it was, I don't know, writing code was always a thing that I did.
Yeah. You know? And you taught yourself at a young age? Yeah. Just playing around, you would say?
Just playing around. I started using Access, you know, for Microsoft.
Yeah.
Then inside Access, you can actually create, use Visual Basic, VB6.
Yeah.
So that's where I started.
Nice.
Yeah. But the thing is that, so basically what I like is like, I learned that I will always find the answer if you know what is the problem or what is the question, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's why I'm comfortable doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Would you say nowadays, let's say for people listening or people even in your audience that haven't done anything with programming, would you say now you can still teach yourself and let's say up to a point where you can be productive and solve problems that you see, just like the one you mentioned?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. I think that's the best way of learning.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And nowadays you have AI to help you. You have people online in a Discord server or Reddit or Twitter. You can ask questions or even in the comment section of YouTube.
Yeah, there's multiple communities nowadays. Yeah. I fully agree with you there. Yeah. How much have you played around with kind of using AI to develop software?
I'm using more, but I don't like copilots.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't like the feeling of suggestions, code suggestions coming to me without me asking, you know?
I
like, I'm not asking for a suggestion, but I'm typing and then GitHub Copilot is trying to figure out what I want.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I feel like I'm not driving the car, you know?
Yeah. Okay. So the co-pilot aspect is you're kind of the co-pilot.
Yeah. Hmm. I think it breaks my flow.
Okay.
Because when I'm coding, I have hyper focus on code. So when I'm coding, like the world can be falling apart. I will like be focused on my code.
Yeah.
And I think co-pilots, they make me lose the focus.
Yeah. I can see that. I haven't played around with Copilot, let's say integrated in the IDE. I do the, what you said, the conscious going out of it, asking a question, then using that as input. Yeah. And it's mostly because from the client side, I can't use that. But also from an interest perspective, I haven't really played around with it. Because I think what I do now solves kind of my needs when I think I need a problem. And it might be making me less productive, but I still see this as kind of a mental challenge where I want to figure out something. It's also from a fulfillment perspective. It's nice to do it, but I use it just like I use Google, except I've started using that more than Google even.
Same.
Yeah.
Same here.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't use Google anymore or Stack Overflow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I sometimes do, but then I'm like, maybe if I go through multiple articles and I still can't figure it out, I'm like, why am I doing this? Yeah. I like that a lot.
But that's easier when you have experience. Like, I think when you are starting, the problem maybe is to delegate to the AI your roadmap to study, or, you know.
Yeah.
So, because, yeah, the AI can be not lying, but can be making stuff up.
Yeah, the hallucinations.
Yeah.
Those are funny.
So if you don't have experience, you won't be able to cut this. Yeah,
I agree with that. One of the final thoughts I had was, we were talking about content creation and we were talking about your schedule. And you said we a lot. Are you doing this by yourself, or what is kind of the team? What does it look like?
The team, it's me and my wife, Sarah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah.
How is it working with your wife? Because I know she's listening. I know you can't say too many bad things.
No, I don't have anything bad to say.
It's been good?
Yeah. Awesome. It's amazing, actually.
Mm.
Yeah, because, for instance, when I have an idea and... It just feels good to have someone to share the ideas, and also to get you get like a quick feedback, you know. So because Sarah, she does the editing,
yeah,
but she does more like she does the whole. She's basically the CEO of Lucas Montan Corporate because she handles the partners and all this kind of stuff.
Nice,
yeah, but also. She gives me feedback about the content or about, so it's like a social media, you know, training or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's good because then, for instance, sometimes I will post something or I tweet something and then she can see like things that I'm not seeing.
Mm.
Yeah. So that's really good. And we are always in sync.
Okay.
Because we are daily talking about content or, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so fun.
Yeah.
I started a YouTube channel with my partner as well and her sister. So it was kind of the three of us. And it was more so in the fitness space where I would do the production and the editing and stuff like that. And they would do the videos, great fitness videos. And it was fun. And when we were in sync, it was a lot of fun because in our personal time, we could brainstorm and this was really something we were building up. But when it was not, like when we would butt heads or have, let's say, conflicting opinions where we were not in sync, sometimes it would bleed into our regular life, the non-work life or the non-YouTube life. And that was pretty challenging at some point.
Yeah, it is challenging.
Yeah.
But we are doing that, I think, for 2 or 3 years now together.
Yeah.
So I think we learn how to, you know, let's stop talking about the YouTube channel.
Yeah.
So I think now we can switch back to, okay, let's just be, you know, us.
Yeah.
Not be like YouTube partners.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I like that a lot. Have you ever thought about expanding the team? Because I'm going to show you, actually, I think when this episode comes out, the episode that I'm talking about already came out. I talked to Arjan and he does Arjan Codes on YouTube, a lot of Python content creation. And he's recently also released a lot of Rust videos and he wants to expand. And when he talked about his YouTube team, every time he wanted to do something new, he was thinking about what he needs to do when it comes to editing or creating content or creating courses. And he would bring someone on his team to help him with that aspect. And then he could do something new. And his team is now a lot of people. Like, it surprised me that from a YouTube perspective, I always thought about, okay, you have a person that's on camera that does the content creation, maybe an editor, but he has people that help him with social media, people that help him with courses that he creates, people that help him with business automation, where he has scripts running on his YouTube channel, on his comment sections for people that give suggestions. And then that goes into like a whole Notion thing where he just has ideas from the audience, let's say. And people think about those types of automations.
Yeah.
That surprised me. Like, it was very cool to hear about that.
Yeah. We actually have a new member now.
Mm.
So it's me, Sarah, and Tony.
Okay.
We call the Tony.
Yeah.
So the Tony is an AI, actually.
Oh.
It started as a joke in a video that I made. Like, Tony was one of the characters that were like the junior developer in a video. And then when OpenAI released the GPTs, they also brought like actions. So now you can basically create your API.
Yeah.
So I created a Google Cloud function. And you can use Swagger API scheme to tell GPT how to communicate with your API.
Okay.
So for the suggestions, what I did is like, now you can go to the Tony on GPT and you can say like, I want to send a suggestion to Lucas.
Mm.
And then he replied, okay, what is your suggestion? Then you can just send tell the GPT this, the suggestion.
Yeah.
And GPT will get this and create a payload based on my Swagger scheme. Yeah. And it will send to my Google Cloud function.
Ah, perfect.
Yeah.
And that then processes it and stores it.
Stores it. And then I have a private GPT that I can ask, okay, what are the suggestions that people send me this week?
Yeah.
Then he will use the same Swagger scheme to hit the Firestore Firebase, real-time database and from Firebase.
Yeah.
And it will just tell me, okay, these are the suggestions. So I think we can automate more.
Mm.
So before bringing more people, I think first we can work automating stuff.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. Like you have AI team members.
Yeah. And the YouTube channel is like a platform for projects.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, I work in together with a company called Olympus.
Okay.
To create a memo flashcard app. So people can learn like topics like Agile or JavaScript using flashcards.
Nice.
Yeah. So we did that project with this company. We did open source and we brought partners to sponsor the project. So I create content. The company developed the app.
Yeah.
We released the app together. I brought audience to the app and sponsors paid for it, right?
Exactly. And the audience learns.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And also now, Sarah, me, and Neto Marin, it's our partner. We founded a new company in Brazil called App Academy. So, yeah, like we have like more partners, but then it's not on the YouTube channel. Then we create a new entity and then we start this project.
Yeah. Really nice. Yeah, that's cool. I like the part of automating whatever, let's say, teamwork you would need. And I think he's doing that as well. And I think it's really smart to kind of simplify the workload that you have. Because if you have two people, and I get it, if you have, let's say, this core team, it's hard to expand with more people. It might disrupt the dynamic. But automating processes to make kind of your lives easier, that makes a lot of sense in that way.
Yeah.
For all the solutions that you're building, are those open source available to the public as well? Or most of them, let's say?
The Memo app is open source.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think that's the only project, big project. Mm. Yeah.
So I was wondering for the, let's say, the Mr. Beast example where you were playing around with Rust, why didn't you open source that or that type of stuff?
I will.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's just like, I think it's like 40 lines of code.
Yeah. So it's barely anything.
Yeah.
Okay.
I can create a Git repository for that.
Yeah.
But the entire content, it was like around five lives and 7 hours of content, me coding. But this is private only for members.
In that way. Yeah, yeah, okay. So then open sourcing that would kind of be counter.
Yeah.
Kind of. Yeah, I get that. Yeah. Cool, man.
Do you do members here?
No, I don't. I saw like I get this monthly update from YouTube. And they said you can now give your subscribers free memberships when they first subscribe, or you can just gift them. And I've thought about what I would do membership-wise, but I don't have any inspiration yet. Yeah. For me, doing this already takes a lot of effort, and I want to keep doing it weekly. I'm having a blast with it. But I do like giving like something nice for audiences that want to give something back as well in that way. I like it.
Yeah, yeah, and sometimes people want to contribute to life.
Yeah. I've seen that as well. Yeah. Maybe I'll pick your brain. Maybe you have some suggestions. Yeah, but we'll do that after. This has been a lot of fun, man. Yeah. I've had a blast chatting with you. Is this kind of what you expected coming into it?
Yeah.
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 Good stuff.
I'm a bit more nervous than I was imagined, but it was great to talk to you.
Yeah. Good. Happy. Then I'm going to round it off here. Thank you so much for watching, everyone. I'm going to put all Lucas' socials in the description below. Check him out. Let him know you came from our episode. And with that being said, thank you for listening. We'll see you on the next one. Beyond.